From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If the proper study of mankind is man, you couldn't pick a better pair of specimens to write about than mathematicians Alan Turing and Kurt Gödel.
People who are absolutely heroic beyond almost human ability, and yet their weaknesses are also so much more terrifying than ordinary weakness.
This hour, we'll talk about the sometimes uneasy relationship between the mind and the brain. Physicist and novelist Jan Levin will tell us why her subjects ended up as suicides. And novelist Nick Hornby cheerfully explains that none of his characters, who meet on the top of the tall building they all intend to leap off of, actually take the plunge. But first, the most powerful brain medicine in our pharmacological arsenal, music.
We use music for self-medication. A fan that Joni Mitchell met recently told her, "Thank God there's Prozac now, but in the 70s we had you."
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist who runs the Laboratory for Musical Perception, Cognition, and Expertise at McGill University in Montreal. In the old days, before he became a respected academic, Levitin was a well-known session musician, sound engineer, and record producer. Somewhere along the way, he started writing. His work appears widely in scientific journals and music trade publications like Grammy and Billboard. And now, he's written a book. It's not for specialists. Anybody with a brain and an interest in music can enjoy it. It's called This Is Your Brain on Music. Levitin came to visit us in Madison and talked with Anne Strainchamps about music and how we hear it.
If I draw you a triangle, you recognize that it's a triangle no matter what size it is or what color it is. We say in the jargon of my field that it's transposition invariant. I can transform the triangle and it retains its identity. Mm-hmm. And we say the same thing about melodies. I can move them around in pitch space the way I would move a chair around in 3D Cartesian space. The chair is still a chair, whether it's on my head or under my bum. And the melody is still a melody, the same one, whether it's at the top of the piano or the bottom of the piano. And, you know, composers know this, of course, and they exploit this. This is what Beethoven does in the Fifth Symphony. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. It's really the same melodic idea, and he's just moved it around in pitch space. And he knows that you're going to notice that. Even if you can't describe it to me, there's some part of your brain that's registered a similarity there. And then he plays around with both pitch and time when he goes, bum, 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 ba, dum, bum, bum, ba, dum, bum, bum, ba. Right? So now he's sped it up, and he's moved it all over the piano keyboard or the orchestral range. And it's really just the same idea.
You know, we take it for granted that we can hear this stuff and that it makes sense to us. But it sounds like you're saying that this is actually a much more complex kind of business than we think. For instance, could you teach a computer to recognize and enjoy Beethoven's music?
Well, enjoy is a whole other conversation about whether the computer would enjoy it. But recognize, we as a field are making some inroads into getting computers to recognize music. But it's very, very difficult. The human brain does things that the fastest and most sophisticated computer we have can't approach. I can play you two different versions of the same song, you know, as different as Joe Cocker and Peggy Lee, both doing Cry Me a River, and you would instantly recognize it's the same song. We don't have a computer that can do that. The computer can look for things that are identical. It's not very good at looking for things that are similar.
One of the things that you've done that's so interesting is you've looked at how the brain hears and responds to music, and then you have looked at the ways in which composers and performers have played around with music as a result. And you brought a bunch of examples for us. I wondered if we could talk about some of those.
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so special about it is that almost all music has this sense of momentum. It's going somewhere, but it's going somewhere at a regular pace. Music has this beat, and in most music that we listen to, across genres, classical, hip-hop, rock, jazz, there's this very strong sense of when the next one's going to happen. Now, composers play around with that a bit. We still know more or less when something's going to happen, but we don't know exactly what is going to happen. I brought an example of Stevie Wonder playing the drums. Many people don't know this, but he's a fantastic drummer, and he plays drums on most of his records.
Huh.
And in this little cut I brought from Superstition, what you're going to hear is him opening up the song on the hi-hat. These are cymbals that he's playing with his right hand. And any other drummer, I think, to set this up would basically go t t t t, or maybe if they were more elaborate, t t t t t t t t t t t. They'd give you a kind of repetition of the hit, and you'd know exactly when something's going to happen, and you'd be able to predict both when and what. Stevie don't do that. He's playing around, and through the whole song, every time he goes through this pattern, he plays something slightly different. He hits the cymbals a little bit harder or a little bit softer. He adds extra beats. He takes a few beats away. It's sort of a game that he's playing with you, and you're both in on it. He's drawing you into this kind of musical game or puzzle of, what do you think I'm going to do next? Well, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't.
What is it that makes music pleasurable? This seems like an obvious question, I guess, because we all think music is pleasurable. But why? I mean, when Stevie Wonder plays the drums that way, why is it we like it?
We now know, and it's pretty exciting, that there are pleasure centers in the brain, that when you have any pleasurable activity, these things become involved. And the neurons start firing, and they choreograph a kind of neurochemical release and uptake that allows dopamine to be squirted out through the brain. Dopamine is the feel-good neurotransmitter. Other neurochemical processes come into play that keep the dopamine in there a little longer than usual. Other neurons start firing that kind of stimulate your motor cortex and get you that tingly feeling.
So you want to dance?
Yeah, maybe. And it turns out that if you eat chocolate, or if you win a bunch of money, or you have an orgasm, these neural circuits come online, these pleasure centers, and they're the same ones that come online when you listen to music you like. There's no one piece of music that does it to everybody. The idea is that, you know, it's music that you like, and that will do it.
Now, related to this, I wanted to ask you about groove, which you wouldn't think of as a technical scientific term, but you have a whole kind of chapter, a section of a chapter in there about what you call groove. What is it?
Well, I guess it's not scientific because we can't define it. It's one of those things like, you know, well, I know it when I hear it, right? And it's also different for different people. I think what Pakistani audiences consider groove is different than what we consider groove. But really, I'm using it to say something that makes you want to get up and dance or tap your foot or tap the foot in your mind. And really, a lot of what that's about is this idea of anticipation. What's going on in your brain is that your cerebellum is trying to track the regularity of events in the world all the time. That's one of its jobs. It's synchronizing, and in part of the synchronization, it's trying to figure out what's going to happen next and when. And the cerebellum's also connected to your motor cortex, so it sort of induces you to want to tap your finger or snap your finger or clap or move your foot. And I brought another example. I think superstition has this great quality. But also, I think Tell Me Something Good by Rufus has it, and you'll hear that here. One of the reasons it has it is because it's not exactly the same each time. Each time you hear one of the instruments, there's some subtle difference in it. And so what that's doing is it's preventing your cerebellum and the rest of your brain from habituating to it. It's very easy to habituate to, you know, if your refrigerator is running in the background of your apartment.
You tune it out after a while, stop hearing it.
Unless the sound changes.
No, well, that has clear evolutionary advantages.
Well, sure, because a change indicates that something's about to happen that's different, and that could be a foe, it could be a predator, it could be a potential mate, it could be a food source. You have to know. So because the music changes around, it's constantly keeping our brains involved. And what you're hearing on the backbeat is a wah-wah guitar. So you hear the bass go boom, and then you hear a whack, boom, whack, boom, whack, boom, whack. And the whack is this guitar, and it's a little bit different every time, partly because the guitarist is really skilled, but also you're dealing with a human being who's not able to behave or play like a machine.
Another way composers and performers play with expectations has to do with chords, which chords they use. And there's a story you tell about Joni Mitchell and some trouble she had with bass players. I wondered if you could tell that story.
Bass players typically in pop music are playing the root of the chord. If I'm sitting at the piano keyboard and I play some cluster of notes, typically one of them is the theoretical root. The best way to describe it is it's sort of like the anchor point. It's the point that your ear is drawn to.
It's home.
Right. It's the harmonic home. And Joni writes her and invents her own chords and her own voicings. And she doesn't know any music theory. So bass players used to ask her, well, what's the root of that chord? Because they wanted to know what to play. And she didn't know, and so her producer, Henry Louis, used to tell them and her what the root was, and then they would play it. But Joni felt that the music lost something as soon as they did play that note. And the idea is that, uniquely among popular songwriters, she writes ambiguous chords, chords that could be interpreted in two or more different ways. Now, a lot of pop writers, Billy Joel and Stevie Wonder and the Beatles, use ambiguous chords, but they usually fix them with a bass note. Joni wanted to not fix them, which meant that they existed more impressionistically. They couldn't be tied down. So when she finally met Jaco Pastorius, the late Jaco Pastorius, the bass player from Weather Report, she met a really kindred spirit because he didn't ask her what the root was and he didn't look for it. He danced around the ambiguity, which allowed her music to maintain a more ethereal and I think really a more open-ended quality.
Is that what makes her music, gives it that kind of floating quality?
I think so. And it's one of the things that allows you to hear her music differently each time you hear it, because it lives in that world of ambiguity. In a sense, it's like a cubist painting, where you might see a face from two different perspectives at once. What the cubists were trying to do there was mimic the brain. The idea that the brain can recognize your face dead on or in profile or from all different angles. But in real life, because of this pesky thing called the fourth dimension, we can only see one view at a time. But the brain is able to process all these different views sequentially, and the cubist wanted to collapse across the fourth dimension and present at one instant both views of a face. And I think what Joni was trying to do was the musical equivalent. Present both views of a musical chord progression. And Jaco allowed her to do that.
I met a friend of spirit. He drank and womanized.
Do you think our music is getting more complex over time? Because it strikes me that music like that with these very unresolved chords, if you'd played that 200 years ago, people would have thought it was ugly.
Well, I think that the world is getting more complex, certainly. I mean, that's the whole principle of entropy, isn't it? I think that in the grand scale, music's getting more complex. I mean, you have to look at the average and you have to look at trends, because I don't think Britney Spears is any more complex than the Strawberry Alarm Clock was 30 or 40 years ago. But certainly there are trends of composers pushing the boundaries of what we consider cordant and discordant and what we consider consonant and dissonant, and what we consider beautiful.
I guess I was wondering whether you could kind of say that music and our brains are evolving together.
I would say, yeah.
Because the picture you've set up with the way composers play with expectations, every generation is going to build on the expectations that the previous generation set up. So every new generation is going to kind of have to set the bar a little higher, do something new and more varied. So in a way, our brains are carrying the entire history of music composition.
Well, I think that's right.
We're all evolving together.
I think that's right. And I brought a little clip that I think demonstrates that. So for people of our generation who sort of grew up on the Beatles and Elton John and this style of music, you're right. If somebody wants to continue in that tradition, they have to make it a little more complex. But they still have to be grounded in that tradition harmonically, and they have to throw in enough of the little nuggets of that that you'll recognize that they're standing on the shoulders of these icons. So here, I brought you one of my favorite songs by one of my favorite new artists. His name is Owsley. The song, just for you, is called Oh No, the Radio. You know, he's a young guy.
Uh-huh.
It's very modern and techno, and the first time I heard that, I think I got a smile on my face from ear to ear. It was just indescribable.
Oh no, the radio is playing that song again. No, 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 the radio follows me everywhere I go.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal. He talked with Anne Strainchamps. His book is called This Is Your Brain on Music. The Science of a Human Obsession. If you enjoyed Daniel Levitin's music examples, visit our website at ttbook.org. We'll link you to his. He has dozens more. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. A comedy about suicide sounds like a tasteless joke, but British novelist Nick Hornby gets away with it. His latest book is called A Long Way Down. It's the story of a group of people who all head for the roof of a London high-rise with the intention of flinging themselves off. As Hornby quickly reassured Steve Paulson, none of them actually go through with it. After all, it's a long way down. Here's Nick Hornby with a bit of the book.
Can I explain why I wanted to jump off the top of a tower block? Of course I can explain why I wanted to jump off the top of a tower block. I'm not a bloody idiot. I can explain it because it wasn't inexplicable. It was a logical decision, the product of proper thought. It wasn't even a very serious thought either. I don't mean it was whimsical. I just meant that it wasn't terribly complicated or agonised. Put it this way. Say you were, I don't know, an assistant bank manager in Guildford, and you'd been thinking of emigrating, and then you were offered the job of managing a bank in Sydney. Well, even though it's a pretty straightforward decision, you'd still have to think for a bit, wouldn't you? You'd at least have to work out whether you could bear to move, whether you could leave your friends and colleagues behind, whether you could uproot your wife and kids. You might sit down with a bit of paper and draw up a list of pros and cons. You know, cons, aged parents, friends, golf club. Pros, more money, better quality of life, house with pool, barbecue, etc. C, sunshine, no left-wing councils banning bar-bar black sheep, no EEC directives banning British sausages, etc. It's no contest, is it? The golf club? Give me a break. Obviously, your aged parents give you pause for thought, but that's all it is, a pause and a brief one, too. You'd be on the phone to the travel agents within 10 minutes. Well, that was me. There simply weren't enough regrets and lots of reasons to jump. The only things in my cons list were the kids, but I couldn't imagine Cindy letting me see them again anyway. I haven't got any aged parents and I don't play golf. Suicide was my Sydney, and I say that with no offence to the good people of Sydney intended.
Why did you want to write a novel about suicide?
Partly I wanted to take characters who were in a very, very dark place and lead them towards the light. You know, I have to say the book isn't really about suicide in that, you know, it's not giving anything away to say that none of my major characters kill themselves. So in that way, it's really about being in a bad place rather than actually doing away with yourself.
Well, tell me about your four main characters. How would you describe each of them?
Well, Martin is what we call here a breakfast TV presenter. He's in his 40s and he's just come out of prison because he slept with a 15-year-old girl that he met in a nightclub. As a consequence, he's lost his wife and kids, or lost contact with his wife and kids, and he feels that he's got nowhere to go, which is why he's on the top of this building. Maureen is in her 50s and the mother of a very severely disabled son. Jess is a very damaged girl in her late teens. And JJ is a rock musician who's stranded in London and whose luck's run out and his band's broken up, and he's someone else who can't see any route to the future.
Now, I don't know if this is true, but I took JJ to be the closest thing as a stand-in for you, maybe a younger version of you, I don't know, and JJ is, I'm guessing, around 30 or so, and I'm figuring that probably what he's going through is what a lot of people of that age have gone through. I mean, kind of their adolescent dreams have gone up in smoke, and it seems like they have nothing left, and it's time to get on with their career, with their life, and so far they don't seem to have much to show for themselves.
Yes, you're absolutely right that he's somebody I feel quite close to. But I think that when I was 30, I did feel pretty washed up. I think one of the hardest things about any artistic endeavor is that you feel that you're a long way away from everybody that you grew up with and maybe everyone you were at college with or school with who all are starting to maybe earn a bit of money and just starting to have kids and somewhere nice to live. And people who are, I don't know, painting or writing poetry or making music or writing novels or trying to act, they just can't figure any way back to that position. And I think it can be a very, very frightening time. And it feels like walking the plank. You can't go back because it's too humiliating. So you feel that you have to go forward, but there doesn't seem to be much there either.
And also, there's this often this feeling that there is something you're supposed to, not necessarily to achieve, but there is some potential you are supposed to reach in life. And there's a nagging feeling that you might never reach it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I hope is clear in the book is that JJ does have talent, you know, that it's not a completely unrealizable dream. It seems unrealizable to him at the moment of the book. But yeah, there's something in that he feels needs to come out, but he's being denied that opportunity.
But on the other hand, he realizes that he's never going to be a rock star, the thing that he's always dreamed of. That's just not going to happen. But ultimately, he also realizes he can't give up the music, even if it's just playing for pennies.
Yeah, that he is a musician, and that's kind of a big realization for him, that it's actually nothing to do with the money. It just defines who and what he is.
Now, we've been talking about some of the characters in your novel A Long Way Down, and another one is Maureen, this woman in her 50s who has a severely disabled son. And I took her to be the one person who seemed to have most cause to jump off that building, frankly. I mean, she seemed to be the most trapped, the most despairing. Where did that character come from?
Well, I have an autistic son myself, and she's not me. Very much she's not me, and her son isn't my son. But over the last few years, I've been introduced to a world that I actually knew very little about before I had kids. And in fact, you know, people who have, as it were, normal kids wouldn't know much about this world either. So I've heard from or met quite a few people like Maureen. And one of the things that interested me about her was exactly that, that her problems would seem, I think, from the outside to be the most intractable. And all the time when I was conceiving the book, I knew I only had to give her a couple of tweaks to make her life livable again. And it was something that I could disguise from the reader just as it's disguised from the other characters, if you see what I mean.
Hmm. Did you go through periods like that, maybe earlier on with your son, when there seemed to be no way out?
You know, it's an incredibly difficult thing to have to take on. And certainly when you first find out, there's a long period of grieving, I think, that of course is extremely uncomfortable. But, you know, in lots of ways, I'm lucky and Danny's lucky and he has lots of support. We have lots of support. There's money, which, you know, actually does make things much, much better. And really, Maureen was a way of showing sympathy and interest in the people who aren't as fortunate as we were.
Could you read a passage from Maureen? And we should point out
sure.
that each of your chapters is told in the voice of a different character. And so,
I'm no actor.
No, but go ahead.
I think they picked me because I hadn't really said anything and I hadn't rubbed anyone up the wrong way yet. And also maybe because I was more mysterious than the others. Martin, everyone seemed to know about from the newspapers, and Jess, God love her, we'd only known her for half an hour, but you could tell that this was a girl who had problems. My own feeling about JJ, without knowing anything about him, was that he might have been a gay person, because he had long hair and spoke American. A lot of Americans are gay people, aren't they? I know they didn't invent gayness, because they say that was the Greeks, but they helped bring it back into fashion. Being gay was a bit like the Olympics. It disappeared in ancient times, and then they brought it back in the 20th century. Anyway, I didn't know anything about gays, so I just presumed they were all unhappy and wanted to kill themselves. But me, you couldn't really tell anything about me from looking at me, so I think they were curious. I didn't mind talking because I knew I didn't need to say very much. None of these people would have wanted my life. I doubted whether they'd understand how I'd put up with it for as long as I had. It's always the toilet bit that upsets people. Whenever I've had to moan before, when I need another prescription for my antidepressants, for example, I always mention the toilet bit, the cleaning up that needs doing most days. It's funny because it's the bit I've got used to. I can't get used to the idea that my life is finished, pointless, too hard, completely without hope or colour. But the mopping up doesn't really worry me anymore. That's always what gets the doctor reaching for his pen, though.
Nick Hornby calls his novel A Long Way Down. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Tragically, suicidal thoughts and the depression that leads to them are no laughing matter. But as we've just heard, they can be fertile territory for writers, both established veterans like Nick Hornby and newcomers like Adam Hazlett. Here he is with an excerpt from his story, War's End.
In the bathroom at the hotel, he stands before the mirror trying to recall his reason for being there. "Are you all right in there?" he hears his wife call. He opens his fist and sees the pill he is supposed to take flaking in the sweat of his palm. 10 times, maybe even 20, he has sat on a doctor's couch and answered the same battery of questions about his sleep and interest in sex, his appetite and sense of despair. And he said yes, there was an uncle and a grandmother who, looking back, seemed unhappy in more than the usual ways. And yes, there were his parents who divorced, his mother who always had a few drinks after dinner, and no, he doesn't hear voices or believe there is a plot to undo him. At the end of each of the hours, he's listened to the doctor's brief talk about the new combination they'd like to try, how at first it might make him nauseous or tired or anxious. For years, he's done as he was told, and for stretches of time, he's felt like a living person. Then the undertow returns. Ellen hears of a better doctor, and again he must answer the questions. He's always doubted the purpose of the drugs. Despite all the explanations, he's never been able to rid himself of the conviction that his experience has a meaning. He's been told this is a romantic notion, a dangerous thing to cling to, bad advice for the mentally ill. Perhaps it is, though the opposite has always seemed more frightening to him, lonelier, the idea that so much of him was a pure and blinded waste. "I'm fine," he says softly, rinsing the damp powder into the drain.
Adam Hazlett is starting at the top. His first book was a collection of short stories called You Are Not a Stranger Here. It was a finalist for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. All of the stories in the book touch on mental illness. In these stories, he explores lives that have been marked in some way by people who can't peacefully inhabit their own brains and minds.
Fiction is often taking something that's an experience and turning the volume up in a way. And so we all deal with grief and loss and moments of feeling down. And I think, you know, readers hopefully can sort of see their way into people who are dealing with those issues at some extremity.
Is there a particular reason why this extremity of feeling, this in some cases edges, in some cases depths of mental illness, is something that you want to describe?
I feel as though we learn a lot about people and ourselves when they're pressed to a certain limit. And a short story is often about the most important moment in a person's life, the moment that captures something about their character or an insight into them. So often those moments of extremity are dramatically required for a short story. The other way of answering it is also that I have had experience. I mean, my father was a manic depressive, and so there has been some experience of mental illness in my family.
Well, we should talk a little bit about a few of these. The character in War's End, he's gone to England, to Scotland, actually, with his wife, and his only real desire now is to end his life. Her desire is to keep things going. But you hear the story from his point of view. As a reader, can you believe his story?
I hope so. I mean, I think in that story, he comes to this town in Scotland and he eventually meets this woman who has had a kind of intuition and seen the state that he's in, has intuited the way he's feeling, and sort of draws him into her world. It's almost a sort of tale. I mean, not quite a fairy tale, but almost a sort of tale. And what I wanted to leave the reader with was a sense of what it would be like to occupy the space somewhere between life and death, somewhere between being alive and moving forward and the attraction that death sometimes has for people. I think that's the other thing when I write about some of these characters. There's a tendency to want to give some validity to their experience because with the medical view that we have of a lot of mental troubles and illness now, the temptation is just to say that that experience doesn't mean anything. It's as meaningless as a knee injury or, you know, not having enough insulin in your body. It doesn't have meaning. But the fact is that people experience it as very meaningful because it's in their mind and it's about how they view the world.
The good doctor is another of these. In this case, the narrator seems absolutely trustworthy. Is he?
I think he's a reliable narrator. I think he is. I think
he's the doctor. We have to trust him.
He's the doctor, yeah. I think there's definitely one of the movements in the story is towards the end to make him, the reader understands that his needs are perhaps, you know, as great or greater than the patient's yeah. needs.
In this case, he is, he's moved to a rural area to offer his services.
It's a story about a doctor going somewhere and a psychiatrist confronting a story that is a bit larger than he can handle. He's a young professional and he's sort of been trained to be able to take something in and process it. I feel as though, you know, whenever it was 10 years ago or 12 years ago that Prozac was on the cover of Newsweek and we suddenly had this sort of quick revolution, as it were, to the popular imagination, if not overnight in the medical profession, at least in the popular imagination. And I feel as though I don't have an editorial viewpoint, pro or con. I mean, I'm not somebody here advocating everybody throw away their medication by any means. But it does seem to me that there's a lag between our understanding or what we're being told about it as a medical situation and our more cultural or artistic or just good, serious nonfiction kind of accounts of what it is like to have suffering dealt with as a medical issue. I mean, I think that there's a lot of philosophical issues involved in that. And I don't know that those, I think it takes longer for those to get aired and for people to represent those and think about them. So, I mean, one ambition for the book, I think, which was very belated because it wasn't something I intended, but in retrospect, is that it gives an opportunity for people to think about it.
I'm curious about this because you've said in print before that you didn't know this was going to be a book so much about mental illness. These clearly have to be issues that you're passionate about, though, or you wouldn't have found yourself returning again and again to different facets of that end of human experience.
Yes. No, that's accurate enough. I mean, it may be as simple as, I mean, if I had been asked before the sort of headline of the idea of mental illness had come out, I guess I would have said that grief and loss and apprehending death or contemplating death, other people's or one's own, is to me what's really at the center of a lot of the stories. And it's not something that I think we're very comfortable abiding with. You know, there's a lot of representation of death, there's a lot of violent death we see all the time. But to stay with a person, stay with the mind of someone who's either feeling closer to it or has experienced it in the family or a relative or something, it's less comfortable. And so my goal in a lot of these, and this was more conscious, was to not look away from the mind of these people and to stay with them and see what happened if you wrote all the way into their character at that moment.
Not all of these stories are about mental illness, of course. Many of them are about life, the way we all live it. Mm. But are you suggesting there isn't all that much difference?
There's some suggestion of that. I mean, I think, as I said earlier about turning up the volume, I mean, everybody at some point in their life deals with grief and with loss and with the feeling of being low or a feeling of having more energy than they know what to do with. I mean, all these are familiar emotions to people. Some of the characters in the book deal with them at a heightened state, but I don't think there's a cutoff. It's degree, not kind, the difference that's going on. And I think that's a good thing both for people's ability to empathize with people, characters in more extreme situations, but also perhaps to see into their own emotional life.
Adam Hazlett's book of stories is called You Are Not a Stranger Here. Coming up later, more about music and the brain from Daniel Levitin and just how well some people can learn to hear.
I would go into recording sessions and recording engineers would play this game. One of them would bring in a new record that he had just made and the other engineers in the room would guess what microphone the lead singer was singing into.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Pick through the chaos on our producer's shelves, and you'll find a small white book called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. The book's cover shows an odd diagram full of shapes with words inside connected by arrows. If you puzzle it out, it says, "This is a novel by Jan Levin and a story of coded secrets and psychotic delusions of mathematics and war told by a physicist obsessed with the lives of Alan Turing and Kurt Gödel, a story completely imagined but entirely true." Jan Levin is the physicist, and we took her at her word that this is a novel, but there was plenty that Steve Paulson wanted to know. He asked Jan Levin to read the opening of her book.
"There is no beginning. I've tried to invent one, but it was a lie, and I don't want to be a liar. The story will end where it began, in the middle. A triangle or a circle, a closed loop with three points. At one apex is a paranoid lunatic. At another is a lonesome outcast. Kurt Gödel, the greatest logician of many centuries, and Alan Turing, the brilliant codebreaker and mathematician. These two people converge in history and diverge in belief. They act out lives that are only tangentially related and deaths that are written for each other, inverted reflections. They are both brilliantly original and outsiders. They are both loyal to reason and to truth. They are both besotted with mathematics. But for all of their devotion, mathematics is indifferent. Unaltered by any of their dramas, Gödel's psychotic delusions, Turing's sexuality. 1 + 1 will always be 2. Their broken lives are mere anecdotes in the margins of their discoveries. But then their discoveries are evidence of our purpose, and their lives are parables on free will. Against indifference, I want to tell their stories. Don't our stories matter?"
Your book is called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. What is a Turing machine?
Turing machine started out as a thought experiment. It was when Alan Turing tried to imagine mechanizing human thought, and it was really the precursor to the idea of the computer.
Now, Alan Turing ended up with a very tragic life, well, a tragic end, but he was quite brilliant before that, and there seemed to be a lot of drama in his life. For instance, as he was growing up at boarding school, he seemed to have had some rather miserable experiences, at least as you portray them in your book.
Yeah, he was a bit of an outcast. I think Turing was one of these childlike personalities and childish. He was also probably autistic, so he had trouble reading the emotional current in the room. He really had trouble interpreting an expression on someone's face. He had trouble modulating his voice. He was a very awkward person.
Why was he so drawn to mathematics?
He was a person who loved honesty and truth. It's even wrong to say loved it. It was the only way for him. There was no alternative to brutal honesty and frankness. And the pursuit of truth for him was just an intrinsic desire that he always seemed to have.
Now, later on, Alan Turing turned out to be a critical part of the war effort during the Second World War when he worked for the British for their intelligence office at Bletchley Park. Can you explain what he did there?
Well, he was a cryptanalyst, so he was trying to crack the German Enigma codes. There were literally millions of different possible combinations for cracking this code. It was almost impossible to imagine that it could be done, but he succeeded in doing it. And it really had a huge impact in turning the tide of the war in favor of the British.
Now, you would think that this would have made him a national hero, and yet not. Too much after that, he had a terrible end. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, you'd think he would be a national hero, but Churchill, although he admired them deeply, had a real soft spot for the cryptanalysts. He wanted to keep secret what they had done. So he was never publicly heralded as this great war hero, although privately Churchill and people in the government knew that he was and accepted him as that. But later, when he went to Manchester after the war and he was working on building a real computer, he was involved with a young sort of rogue he picked up on the street. He was homosexual, and he made no attempt to suppress his homosexuality or to hide it, and he had been burgled by an associate of this person he was having an affair with, Arnold Murray. And he went to the police to tell them about the robbery, and people told him not to go to the police. It wasn't much that was stolen. It was a few odds and ends, nothing serious. But this is a person who could not let go of something that was wrong. He could not live with something that was not right, not honest, not forthright. And so he went to the police and in the process disclosed that he had a homosexual affair and was very soon after arrested for gross indecency, as it was called.
And what happened after that?
Well, there was a trial. He was convicted, and the sentence at the time was either prison or hormonal castration, and he was given chemical castration. He was given doses of estrogen over a 2-year period and eventually an estrogen implant, which he was allowed to have removed when the sentence was over. But this left him obese. He grew breasts. He became profoundly depressed, and he never really rebounded. About 2 years after that, he committed suicide.
By eating a poisoned apple.
Yes, he bit from a poisoned apple. Snow White was his favorite movie, and he used to run around chanting, "Dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through." So he was a real character. He was fascinated by this movie, and then for him to take that to actually use this as his suicide, he dipped an apple in cyanide, bit from the apple, and died very swiftly.
You would think that someone, knowing his history, knowing that all he had accomplished, knowing his patriotism, would have rescued him.
It was just sort of a tragedy. Here is this outcast, but this charming, likable, sweet, but really not functional person who, again, falls prey to exactly that combination. He's frank, charming, sweet, and open, and yet just does not seem to understand the social current or what it meant that he was disclosing his homosexuality or what could happen to him.
Now, there's another major historical figure in your novel. Is Kurt Gödel the dreaming madman of your title?
You know, that's a good question. I played with the title could be planted on various things. I mean, you could say Gödel was clearly more insane than Turing. Turing was not insane. He was odd, or eccentric, rather. But Gödel was a paranoid schizophrenic. He really did have breaks with reality. And so you could imagine he is the madman dreaming of Turing machines. But I think in the book I was playing a lot with the idea of truth and what's true and the narrator being a liar, so that at some point it's hard to know if the narrator has invented everything and if any of it's real. And then you have to wonder at some stage if the reader is inventing everything, if any of it's real, you know, so the reader has to feel a little mad in the process of reading the book, not knowing what they can really claim as real and true.
Now, this is another remarkable story. I mean, you just mentioned that Kurt Gödel was a schizophrenic. I mean, he sort of slipped in and out of reality. He's also considered one of the greatest logicians who's ever lived.
Absolutely, probably the greatest logician since Aristotle. He was a tremendous mind. I mean, he did things that eluded everyone else, that no one could find. He could find it hidden there, this remarkable nugget of mathematical truth that was just so difficult to get at. He was clearly a genius, but he had trouble believing in ordinary reality. He really believed that numbers were real and that circles were real, and there was this platonic reality that he could get to just by the power of his mind. And he trusted it more than he trusted this ordinary reality, which had to do with people and germs and things that he really couldn't measure or be sure were real. He was very confused about reality.
Now, Kurt Gödel also had a tragic end. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it's, again, in direct reflection of Turing's suicide. It's almost a perfect opposite, perfectly carved opposite. He was so afraid that his food was being poisoned, that the government was poisoning him, that he stopped eating altogether. Now, he had had a lifelong history of self-starvation, and he had often dropped to dangerously low weights, but his wife, Adele, who was much older than him and very motherly, would nurse him back to health spoonful by spoonful until he gained some weight. But she fell ill and was unable to care for him. And without her, I think he just fell apart. He lost his grip entirely. And he starved himself to death. He was 65 pounds when he died. And even in the hospital, they couldn't get him to eat.
Now, are you drawing a link between madness and genius here?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I'm not really. And I don't think Turing was mad. He was not.
But Gödel was.
There are lots. Gödel was, but he wasn't mad while he was doing his great work. And that doesn't mean there isn't a link, obviously. People say maybe if you're vulnerable to madness, it's also something in your brain chemistry that makes you open to great insight or great genius. But we've had a lot of geniuses who are not insane. Einstein is the greatest genius of, you know, physics for 300 years. And or Richard Feynman, who's another physics genius, was clearly not insane, a very socially smooth, suave, sort of charismatic person. But I think that there's something fascinating in the story, just in terms of its sort of human character, that there's these people who are absolutely heroic beyond almost human ability, and yet their weaknesses are also so much more terrifying than ordinary weakness. And there's something about that tragic combination that I think is very fascinating, and it's kind of an exaggeration of what everyone sort of feels, that there's something about them that's great, but there's also the same thing that's usually terrible or ridiculous. And so I think it kind of appeals to us to see these bigger, epic versions of the human predicament.
But it does make you wonder if somehow their weaknesses, whether it's just gross social incompetence or in Gödel's mm-hmm. case, you know, these episodes mm-hmm. of madness, whether mm-hmm. whether that in fact, well, it didn't necessarily make them geniuses, but it contributed to their obsessive quality to pursue mathematics as they did.
Well, I do think that is true. I do think that it takes a certain willingness to be outside of an ordinary life and be outside of an ordinary world. And I really did want to convey that to people reading it, to step inside this other world, these people who get their meaning in life from the purity of mathematics, from that pursuit. I'm not going to call it religious, but I think it does lend a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of context, and it gives their lives a richness that they cannot find in the ordinary world, in the ordinary kind of life. And it's those things like being obsessively logical, devoted to truth, brash and blunt, and again obsessive, that makes them on the outside of the rest of the world.
Jenna Levin is a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College of Columbia University. She spoke with Steve Paulson. A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines is her first novel. That was such a sad story that we didn't want to end here. Fortunately, before we let Daniel Levitin go back to Montreal, Anne Strainchamps had a surprise for him.
Well, I have a clip I wanted to play you. This is a recording I did of a local fourth grade class.
Oh, I'd really want to hear that.
In their strings class. And
okay.
Here they are playing Kookaburra. So the thing I wonder is, when you hear kids like that learning, obviously learning, to play instruments, what's going on in their brains?
Well, one of the things that's going on in their brains is that they're hearing the way the music should be, and they may not be hearing the way it is. Many of us have what you could call a self-monitoring deficit. We don't know what we sound like, you know, until we hear our voices back on the radio or a tape. We don't really know what we look like or how others see us. And there's, I guess, some deep psychological reason why we don't really see ourselves as others do, because to a large degree, we can't do a whole lot about it. I mean, there is a class of us in society that do control all of that, and we call them actors. But the rest of us don't have that ability, really. And I think, you know, the fourth graders are probably hearing themselves and thinking, that sounds pretty good. You know, they recognize it as Kookaburra, and, you know, although some of the notes and the rhythms are off, they may not hear that. The other thing is, you know, their brains may not have developed yet enough to make those subtle distinctions. Adults are much better at making certain distinctions than children just because our brains are more fully formed.
What does it do for children to learn a musical instrument?
This is the million-dollar question right now. And you may have read these studies several years ago that listening to Mozart 20 minutes...
The Mozart effect.
Right. Mozart makes you smarter. And there was this big rush by NAM, the National Association of Music Merchandisers, the musical instrument makers lobby, to try and get music back in the schools because they said it would make students better at math. Now, you think about this, it's kind of an odd argument, because if you woke up one morning and found out that doing math made you a better musician, would all the school administrators be racing to put more math in the curriculum?
Sadly, no.
It's really one directional. But that said, we don't really know. The experiments that have been done on this issue, that is the ancillary benefits of music instruction, the studies have been inconclusive. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence that people who learn musical instruments have other skills and that they translate to other domains. I would say my answer to this has two parts. One is that people who play a musical instrument and continue to play it seem to get enjoyment out of it. Mm. So it's just another way that we can enjoy ourselves and our lives, another activity we can have that's pleasurable. So I think that's a good thing. It also has been, it definitely has been shown that people who play and listen to music can recover from illness faster and can deal with some of the emotional ups and downs of life a little better.
But haven't you found that learning to play an instrument actually physically changes the brain, that there are sections, parts of the brain that become larger?
Absolutely. In fact, the corpus callosum, the mass of fibrous tissue that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, is larger in musicians than in non-musicians. And we have seen structural changes. I think the big question that a lot of people are after is, will these changes show up as a benefit in some other domain?
In some other area, right.
Like math or race car driving. Or
if you have a bigger corpus callosum, are you better at doing left and right brain tasks?
Right. Now, that's what we don't know for sure. But my hunch is yes, and I'll tell you why. We do know that kids who learn a second language early tend to perform more quickly on a variety of cognitive tasks that have nothing to do with language. But knowing two languages somehow metaphorically greases the wheels of neural connectivity. And if you consider that music is a language, that it's a form of communication, it has its own rules, it has syntax, structure, then there's no reason to think that music wouldn't bring with it the same benefits.
Daniel Levitin is the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, and Strainchamp spoke with him. What you're hearing is music of Mozart, written when he was 8 years old, with a whole lot of help from his father Leopold. Still, a long way from Kookaburra. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, or check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1022A, The Mind, Music, and Math. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.